Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Efforts to combat black lung disease draw criticism.
Some day you just find you dead somewhere from your body just exerted itself so much because you can't breathe that you die of a heart attack or something.
Meet banjo player Lee Sexton.
And he'd wet that string so it'd stay tied to keep me from fooling with it.
A look at efforts in Kentucky and Pennsylvania to save the birds and bees.
Basically, a loss of nesting, suitable nesting habitat as the area was developed.
I had the polar vortex, I had bears, I had skunk damage.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is expected to release new rules on carbon emissions at existing power plants Monday. The rules are expected to force existing coal-fired electric plants to reduce pollution by creating a greenhouse gas emission reduction goal for each state. West Virginia and Kentucky are in the top 8 on a new list that ranks states by the amount of carbon dioxide pollution they produce. The list of states emitting the most CO2 per megawatt hour of power produced is led by the Commonwealth, with West Virginia coming in third. Dan Bockel is with Ceres, an environmental advocacy group that helped prepare the report. He says Kentucky will continue to release high levels of emissions as long as it relies so heavily on coal.
What we're seeing in a lot of other states is that there's a much more diverse portfolio of energy resources. So I think in many ways it's an opportunity for Kentucky to diversify and not be as dependent upon coal.
Officials from coal-producing states have already pounced on the expected announcement, claiming the regulations will cost coal jobs, increase electric rates, and harm the economy. Several members of West Virginia's congressional delegation have issued news releases saying the proposed rules are a continuation of the Obama administration's war on coal. Meanwhile, federal regulators continue their efforts to improve safety in the mines in the wake of 20 U.S. mining fatalities since October. The Mine Safety and Health Administration says it will conduct visits to coal, metal, and non-metal mines to increase awareness of recent fatalities and encourage operators and miners to remain vigilant for unsafe conditions. MSHA is also addressing concerns about miners' health, particularly the increase in recent years of black lung disease. Last month, the agency passed a long-awaited rule that will lower the amount of respirable coal dust in all U.S. underground and surface coal mines. The new standard reduces dust levels from 2 milligrams per cubic meter to 1.5 milligrams. This new standard aims to reduce black lung among miners, but as WMMT's Terrence Ray reports, it's drawn criticism from both the industry and workplace safety advocates.
Letcher County underground miner Scott Howard worked in dusty conditions for 35 years. During that time, Scott developed pneumoconiosis, or black lung disease, and his doctors eventually made him quit in February of this year due to health reasons and injuries sustained in the mines.
We used to breathe a lot of dust in the mines, and they do still yet to today, but it used to be a lot worse. Worked many places, and I never seen a ventilation curtain. You're ignorant of the facts that's going along when you first in the mines because you don't know the law. Then when you learn and you see things and you have to make a decision, if you want to put up with it or fight and if you got a family, you might have to put up with it. I've been there a morning cough so hard I've just passed out and fell out and stand up just in the floor, and my wife and my children are over and think, Daddy, what's wrong? And I say, I'm all right, because, I'll wake back up, but they thought I fell dead, it's scary. And you wonder when your family come home someday and just find you dead somewhere from your body just exerted itself so much because you can't breathe that you died of a heart attack or something.
As part of its End Black Lung, Act Now initiative, MSHA is reaching out to miners and operators in the Central Appalachian coalfields to explain what is included in the new dust standard. Assistant Secretary of Labor for MSHA, Joseph Main, stopped through Hazard, Kentucky on May 20th and spoke to industry stakeholders at the Hazard Community and Technical College.
Well, we're here to provide information to the mining community, mining industry in particularly East Kentucky and Southwest Virginia on the new rule that was issued on April 23rd. It goes into effect on August the 1st. It's a rule that's aimed at ending a disease that's plagued the mining industry for decades. According to NIOSH, who looks at death certificates, a federal agency that compiles information on mining deaths from the disease, over 76,000 miners have died either as a cause or a contribution from black lung. In the state of Kentucky, there's been about 4,500 miners that are on that list over the years. It's a disease that's still ongoing. NIOSH, that does the surveillance work to identify miners who have the disease, have found over 1,000 miners in the last 10-year survey, working miners, that have the disease. For those folks that followed Upper Big Branch, the investigation, it was determined that out of 24 miners that could be examined that didn't survive the disaster, 17 of them had black lung. Think about that. Some of them in their 30s, some of them as low as 5 years experience. That disease is still around, and we need to fix it.
Attorney Wes Addington represents black lung clients at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
This rule doesn't go nearly as far as NIOSH recommended in 1995. They recommended cutting the current level of 2.0 milligrams in half to 1. And the proposed rule that MSHA came out with a couple years ago would have done that. So this final rule sort of splits the difference and only reduces it to 1.5. And that's only phased in after a couple of years. So we won't see those mandated levels for 24 months. MSHA definitely has the science to back up these changes. In fact, I think they have the science to have gone a lot further than they did. That's the next question is, by not reducing it by half, are we going to eradicate the disease?
If the goal is to see this next generation of coal miners not face a future where they would have black lung disease, the agency would have had to come out stronger.
Celeste Monforton is a lecturer at the George Washington University School of Public Health and was a policy advisor at MSHA during the Clinton administration.
You can look at that data and you can actually see by MSHA's decision not to reduce it to 1, there are still a significant number of coal miners who are going to be developing disease at that 1.5 milligram standard. So it is giving more credit to what the rule can accomplish by saying, you know, this rule is going to eradicate black lung disease. I think it's going to reduce the number of coal miners who develop black lung and other adverse health consequences, but it's not going to eradicate the disease.
With regard to not going tough enough, I think there's always more that we can do.
Joe Main, Assistant Secretary of Labor for MSHA.
I think the lowering of the standard is not the great problem that we need to fix here when you look at the array of problems that exist. It is getting a handle on what those dust levels are when those samplers aren't on miners now and what's going on with these other methods of sampling that doesn't give us the true measure of what miners breathe. For those that says this rule is not feasible, look at the stats that we just put out today. We've ran the numbers going into this thing. If mine operators do what we're finding when we're there doing our inspections, our dust sampling on the 8-hour shifts at 80% production, if they do that the rest of the shift, they're going to be in compliance with this rule. We found that for 2013, every sample we took, over 25,000, there's only a little over 1% that would have been out of compliance. The question is, what's going on when the samplers are not on that we're going to get a better handle on?
Shortly after the rule was issued, Murray Energy, which is one of the nation's largest coal companies, announced that it would sue the Obama administration over the, quote, disastrous and politically motivated rule, which fails to protect coal miners and destroys jobs, end quote.
No matter what the regulation that MSHA came out with, the industry would object.
The industry is all about maintaining the status quo, not investing in protecting the health of mine workers, because many mine operators do not bear the burden of having coal miners develop black lung disease. And so it's, you know, to their advantage to not want to have a stronger regulation. So I don't think anyone is surprised that the mining industry is opposing this rule and wants to challenge it in court. They do that with every MSHA regulation.
We've known about the seriousness of the disease for decades in this country. And we've seen thousands of cases of miners who develop serious lung impairment that gets progressively worse, often reduces their lifespan by decades in a lot of cases. And it gives them the sensation that they're smothering to death, that they're basically slowly drowning in their own body. And if you've ever been around a miner who's suffering from the serious effects of this disease and watch their decline, I mean, it's a moral issue. It's supposed to be an advanced society. And if we can keep miners from experiencing that and their families going through that and wives and children losing their dad in their late 40s or their early 50s and missing out on 20 or 30 years of life with their family member, then I think we've got a duty to try to see that that's done.
They get you by threatening your job or making you feel like you have to have this job to support your family. And like, it's like, oh, this guy, he's against coal. He's like, you know, he's don't want, I'm for coal. It's American product and we need it and it gives people jobs, but I don't think you should kill nobody to make a dollar.
Scott Howard, a retired coal miner from Letcher County, Kentucky. We also heard from Celeste Munforton with George Washington University School of Public Health and Wes Addington with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Terrence Ray in Whitesburg.
Coming up, a visit with Kentucky musician Lee Sexton. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. This year marks the 40th anniversary of June Apple Recordings, a record label started in 1974 by Apple Shop, a nonprofit media arts center in Whitesburg, Kentucky. The intent of the label was to document, preserve, and promote the traditional music of the Central Appalachian Mountains. And in a new series, WMMT is looking back at the life and work of several June Apple recording artists. In the first of this series, Parker Hobson focuses on Lee Sexton, a world-renowned traditional banjo player born and raised in Letcher County, Kentucky.
But now, I guess I might have a little different way of playing this old stuff than a lot of them does, you know, but I just, I try to make it as old as I can, you know. Because you take a fella 86-year-old, he goes back a long ways, you know. But I got such a good voice.
Lee Sexton still lives on the land where he was born in 1928, in the community of Line Fork, in the mountains of Letcher County, Kentucky. Over his 86 years, Lee has gained a worldwide reputation as a master of traditional Appalachian banjo playing, and as a living link to a centuries-old banjo tradition from the mountains of East Kentucky. And from his youngest days, music was an integral part of Lee's life. Most everyone in his family played, and he grew up listening to his uncle, Morgan Sexton, who himself was a renowned banjo player that was recognized with a National Heritage Award for his music.
But now Morgan, he worked in the log woods all the time, and he boarded with us. And he'd come in every evening from work and eat supper, and he'd play till dark, buddy. He'd go out the yard getting under a shade tree, you know.
Mama, my grandpa, walked all the way to come and get. Mamma, I'm gonna be walking alone.
And he kept his banjo. He had an old Stella. Kept it in a meal sack. And a big rawhide string, had it tied, that sack, with a rawhide string. And he'd wet that string so it'd stay tied to keep me from fooling with it. And he kept it on the bed all the time. And I'd manage one way or the other to get that string loose. I wanted to play that so bad, I couldn't hardly stand it.
Since he wasn't allowed to play Morgan's banjo, Lee was determined somehow to get his own. He heard a classmate was selling one for a dollar.
Well, I tried to borrow a dollar off my grandfather. He wouldn't let me have it. This bottom right over here, every bit of that big bottom was some corn. They'd done picked the corn. And he told me if I'd cut all of them corn stalks down, pile them up and burn them, he'd give me a dollar to buy that banjo with. And, buddy, I like to work myself to death. Coming in to school, I'd work a hard dark. Me, just a boy, you know, anyhow, about 7 or 8 year old. And I never stopped till I got him wound up, and he give me a dollar. And I run about a mile and a half, down to trot at every step. I bought that, but I still got it. And it didn't have no frets in it, just old wooden screws, and had about 4 or 5 brackets on it. And had a groundhog hide on it. And they'd lift that tail on it. And I got Cribble Creek started. I thought I was Earl Scruggs, buddy.
Lee started playing whenever he could. As a boy, he'd take his banjo to the fields with him and play during breaks in his work. He learned tunes from Morgan, other family members, community members around Line Fork, and from artists he heard on the radio, like Cousin Emmy and Earl Scruggs. He started playing at square dances and family gatherings, and in his teens, he found a gig on the radio himself, on WNVA in Norton, Virginia. It was there that he met Marion Sumner, a fiddle player from nearby Vico, Kentucky, who would end up as Lee's musical partner for more than 50 years. When the radio band split up, Lee went to work in nearby coal mines at the age of 16, but he continued to perform every weekend, and sometimes even took his banjo underground with him.
And I took it to the mines with me one evening and started taking it in the mines, and the superintendent stopped me. I got the man trip with it. I said, don't I get 30 minutes for lunch in there? And he said, yes, sir. I said, you sure do. And I said, that 30 minutes is mine, ain't it? And he said, yes, sir. And I said, well, you telling me that I can't take this banjo in there. I took it in there. Never did. They never said that.
Over the years, Lee gained wide renown as a traditional banjo master, performing for audiences near to the mountains and far. He was included on the landmark Folkways compilation, Mountain Music of Kentucky, in 1960. He released a full-length album on June Apple Records. He received the Governor's Award for the Arts in Kentucky. He appeared in the film Coal Miner's Daughter, and the music video for his signature tune, Woe Mule, even received airplay on cable TV.
Caper dad, whoopee call, bleeper dad, holly, come, 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 come back, going to the brolic. Woe Mule, woe Mule, say, it ain't the time, get you down my mule, train away. Woe Mule, woe Mule, say, it ain't the time, get you down my mule, train away.
But things haven't always been easy. In his younger days, Lee was proficient in three-finger bluegrass banjo, but a mining accident to his right hand forced him to have to learn how to play in a different way, one that made more use of his thumb. More than 3 decades working in coal mines also caused Lee to develop black lung disease. His son Phil, a musician in his own right who played in Lee's band, was killed tragically in a car accident in 2000. And a severe raccoon bite caused so much damage to Lee's right hand in the mid-2000s that Lee had to relearn how to play the banjo again, forcing him to develop a new version of the two-finger style that he first learned from his Uncle Morgan. But despite all this hardship, Lee hasn't slowed down. He and his wife Opal still raise a garden on Line Fork every year. And Lee has remained a pillar of the local music community, teaching lessons, telling stories, and appearing regularly at local dances, jams, festivals, and camps throughout the region. As a result, Lee has played a massive role in keeping traditional music alive in East Kentucky, especially for the next generation of old-time musicians. One of his regular appearances is at the monthly Carcassonne Square Dance in Letcher County.
In my mind, Lee is a banjo legend. He is to be celebrated as a master and a keeper of this of mountain music.
Brett Ratliff is a musician originally from nearby Johnson County, Kentucky. He says he's learned more from Lee than just tunes and techniques.
Lee is definitely an influence on me personally. I appreciate everything that Lee has chosen to bestow upon me. The knowledge, mostly the stories that he shares, they're wonderful stories. And he always talks about Marion Sumner, for instance. And I believe that he'll bring things like that up with somebody like me or John or people like us, and he'll talk to us about those sorts of things because he knows that we're interested and he knows that we think that it's important to hear.
I went and called Marion, come home and called him and act like a woman, change my voice. That's the way it was, isn't it? I said, is this you, Mr. Sub? Marion said, yes, ma'am. So can I help you? I said, well, I'm getting me up a bluegrass band and I need a banjo player. And I'd played to Marion all them years ago. I said, they tell me Lee Sexton's pretty good on that old time stuff. I said, could you tell me something about him? Marion said, now, ma'am, said, I'm just going to tell you the truth. But said, Lord, said, don't you say nothing about this. I said, oh, no, I won't. Marion said, he ain't much. Well, I got tickled. I had to hang a phone up, you know, and I never said nothing about it. No. Friday night over there while we started home, and I said, there'd been somebody talking about my banjo player. Marion said, why, Lee, said, what are you talking about? Said, what did they say? I said, they said I weren't much on a banjo. Marion said, now, he said, I played Jim and Jesse, said, and I played in Nashville. Bob Will said, and I never played with a no better old-time banjo player. I said, you reckon who told that? I said, you did.
To be able, you know, the fact that he's pretty happy-go-lucky with what all he's been through is, you know, inspirational.
Kevin Howard is a traditional banjo player who grew up in Letcher County. He also cites Lee as an influence.
But all the older fellers, like Lee and George Gibson and all those people are... I think they're good role models for anybody who's young and just picking up an instrument, because they have an integrity about them that's undeniable, and they've gained some recognition, you know, built legacies off of it. You know, hopefully some of us younger folks will do that by the time we're that age, if we make it that long.
Lee's style is East Kentucky because it just is. That's where he's at. That's where he's learned his music, and that's where, the banjo tradition in his family comes from. Lee works in the garden. He's been a coal miner. He's had all these different experiences, but when it comes down to it, it's entirely based upon his lived experience in this place that he, you know, looks out at every day. One thing I can say about Lee is that he's very giving with his music, in that every Friday night at Campbell's Branch Community Center, when they do that dance over there and jam, Lee gets a room to himself, and anybody who wants to go over there and take banjo lessons from him is more than welcome to. And so he makes it a point to be there every Friday night for anybody who wants to come in and learn music off of him. I mean, people have traveled from all over the world to go out and sit with Lee, and he is always welcoming to anybody who wants to do that, and wants to sit down and hear his stories, wants to hear him play music. If they want him to teach them something, he's always more than willing to take the time to do that, and I think that speaks volumes about Lee.
I want people to keep it to going, buddy. I don't get near a penny for teaching up here. Not a penny. They paid me a little at first and said they'd run out of funds, and I'm 86 year old, and I ain't got much time left, Kate, you know. And I just want to leave something with them to keep things going, you know. 8 more miles, Louis.
For WMMT and with Rich Kirby, I'm Parker Hobson.
Lee Sexton will be performing at the 28th Annual Seed Time on the Cumberland Festival of Traditional Mountain Music and Art on Saturday, June 7th, on the Apple Shop grounds in Whitesburg, Kentucky. For more information on the festival, you can check out seedtimefestival.org. Lee Sexton's music harkens back to the days before television, computers, and other electronic forms of entertainment, when folks in Appalachia gathered on front porches and in living rooms to swap stories and play music. Essayist Felinia French has some stories to share about growing up in West Virginia during these more simpler times.
Hello, friends. I want to invite you to walk with me through the woods and around the rugged hills of my childhood home in the coal fields of southern West Virginia. Our house was situated on a hillside beside the community water tank with a rock cliff behind it. And the mountains that rose high above the cliff, well, those were my mountains. There was a path around the side of the hill that led us to a garden spot which we tended annually. It was an open plot of ground with good sun exposure, and a natural spring flowed nearby. It was the perfect place for a fresh drink of water. That garden path served a dual purpose, as it was the highway that took us up into the mountains to play and to explore. My childhood in the coal fields was filled with explorations offered by nature. The mountains were my classroom, beckoning me each summer when school was out. It was a great feeling to sleep a little later and then get up and have Mama's gravy and biscuits, pack a picnic lunch consisting of a jelly biscuit and a mason jar filled with water or Kool-Aid, and head out to the mountains. The wide sweeping limbs of the rhododendrons, like outstretched arms, greeted me at each visit. Those limbs formed a canopy under which I sat, quietly undisturbed, to bask in nature. My mountains were always filled with intrigue and beauty. Brilliant white trilliums graced the setting of orange mountain azaleas and crimson-red wildflowers which bloomed in the rich earth beneath the trees. Toadstools had happy homes against the base of the tree trunks, and thick green moss carpeted the grounds around them. One secluded spot beneath the dense growth of trees could paint a vivid portrait. And it did. And every painting has been framed in my memory, and to this day beckons me to visit often. My mountains, my West Virginia mountains.
Felinia French is a writer and storyteller who grew up in West Virginia but currently lives in Christiansburg, Virginia. 50 years ago, when President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty in Appalachia, the hope was to help bring better jobs and more modern conveniences to the region. Organizers of a new initiative in one Kentucky county believe they have a better chance for success than the war on poverty because the effort is community-based. Dream Martin County organizer Eric Mills says President Johnson's programs to improve the lives of people in the Appalachian region came up short because they were directed from Washington. He says Dream Martin County is all about inspiring residents of the Inez area to take matters into their own hands, invest in their community, and encourage others to do so as well.
This is a long-term proposition. This is not, again, something's going to happen in a year or two. But over the course of a generation, we believe we can create growth opportunities that will help local folks see there's more to be had and that will draw outside interests of people who want to come here and live because it's a great place to live. It's a great place to grow a business. It's a great place to send your kids to school.
Mills says another goal is to help Martin Countyans break the cycle of dependency and see that they're capable of much more than receiving a federal supplemental security income check. Up next, we'll talk about the birds and the bees. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Now for that talk about the birds and the bees. We hear a lot of bad news about the future of birds. They're threatened by everything from human development to wind turbines to climate change. The common tern used to nest in great numbers in the lower Great Lakes region, including Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. But in recent decades, common tern nests and their brown speckled eggs have largely disappeared from this region. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports about one effort to encourage their return.
In the 1960s, it was common to see common terns around the Great Lakes. They used to nest by the thousands here around Lake Erie. The graceful seabirds have long, pointed wings and have what looks like a black cap over their head and eyes. They're known for hovering over the water, then plunging in to catch fish in their orange-red bills.
The tern is a small, diving water bird. It's a very good aerialist. It is very effective at maneuvering.
That's Tom Fredette. He's a research biologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He says the common tern's flight skills may help in its recovery around the Great Lakes. Terns still migrate through this region, but they're now considered endangered, threatened, or of concern in most Great Lakes states. Pesticides and egg-stealing raccoons are problems for them, and more adaptable ring-billed gulls have taken over many tern nesting sites.
Basically, a loss of nesting, suitable nesting habitat as the area was developed. So, people have built on the shoreline, and, you know, all of those things have eliminated areas where they historically nested.
The Army Corps is usually known for working with dams and flood protection, but Fredette says they're also trying to bring common terns back to this section of Lake Erie.
Yeah, it is a new idea, and it's an initiative that the Corps of Engineers started a couple of years ago. The phrase we're using is engineering with nature.
We're standing on the shoreline. Fredette points to large concrete walls off in the distance in the lake. They're called breakwaters. He says they were built more than 100 years ago to slow down the water and help boats navigate safely into the harbor. But some are crumbling, and the Army Corps has been repairing the walls. Fredette says in the process, they're trying to help terns. They're using a $300,000 grant to create some nesting areas for common terns in Lake Erie. This is the sound of a common tern. Fredette says they'll be broadcasting the call to draw terns to the breakwalls. When they get there, the terns will see gravel and driftwood strewn around. The Corps also has placed decoy terns and small wooden shelters on the tops of the large concrete walls. It looks kind of messy. Karen Adair is with the Nature Conservancy, which is helping with the project.
In a natural habitat, there'd be driftwood, there'd be shrubs, rocks, there'd be all sorts of things that the chicks could get shelter from. So because this is an artificial structure, we have to provide that protection.
Because the walls are so far out on the water, the tern nests should be protected from varmints, and they're surrounded with mesh fencing to keep tern chicks from running over the edge. Competition for nesting sites is tough among birds. Tom Fredette says the Corps is using cables to make the nests a bit difficult to get to. The idea is to give the common terns a wing up by taking advantage of their special abilities to hover and dive.
The terns are acrobatic enough that they can make it down through that to the nesting site, whereas the gulls and the cormorants aren't able to do that. And so that's one of the ways that we're going to try and keep the area reserved just for the terns.
Fredette says this kind of project has worked in other places, like Buffalo Harbor. He says once these nests are fully constructed, it could take a year or more, but he expects the common terns will return. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Kentucky's new apiarist is also encouraging the return of the bees. There's a shortage of bees across the country thanks to things like disease and pesticide use. Bees are important when it comes to pollinating plants, like crops that supply much of the food we eat. As WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, Tammy Horn sees addressing this problem as her primary role by increasing the number of bees and beekeepers across the Commonwealth.
Tammy Horn is a senior researcher at Eastern Kentucky University and nationally known beekeeping authority. Significant bee loss problems have caused great concern for honeymakers for several years. While there has been a slight improvement in bee numbers in pocketed areas, Horn says it's still a tough situation.
I had 40% losses this year. You know, I had the polar vortex, I had bears, I had skunk damage. I've never had skunk damage in my entire career, even as a hobbyist.
In Kentucky, Horn has worked in Appalachia to further forest bee-based colonies. She says Kentucky has some advantages over other states.
Kentucky has unique floral varieties, and that makes our honey, it can make it more marketable than conventional, say, prairie-based honeys like clover. We have, you know, tulip poplar, black locust.
Americans reportedly consume about 100 million pounds of honey annually, but U.S. beekeepers produce about half that amount. So commercial bakers go to places like China and Argentina to get their honey.
Inevitably, what we end up finding is that the honey that is coming to the United States from these other places often have traces of chloramphenicol and other types of contaminants that our FDA does not approve of.
Horn says some states have acted to establish a honey standard. She says there's no such standard in Kentucky. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. There are a few restaurant chains that have made their scantily clad waitstaff a key element to attracting customers. Over the Memorial Day weekend in north central West Virginia, a lot of skin was on display in one restaurant, but it might not be the skin you're thinking about. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board reports.
Sweden? Sure. We're a locally owned, alumni-run restaurant in Morgantown, West Virginia. We try to source fresh local ingredients. We feature all sorts of great local food. We do barbecue. We kind of, I like to call us New American Soul Food.
Walk into the Atomic Grill, a new barbecue restaurant in Morgantown, and you might be served by waitstaff with purple hair, nose piercings, or tattoos. The cook might have a blue mohawk. Co-owner Dan McCauley says it's a piercing and tattoo-friendly workplace.
You know, maybe like two and a half years ago, we were barbecuing brisket in the backyard and having a beer, and we said, man, we should do this for real. And so, you know, our first initial idea was punk rock barbecue. Let's put some flames on the walls. Let's get some good meat. Let's have a couple of beers and go for it. And it's been fun.
Maybe it's his anti-establishment punk rock background. Maybe it was growing up with five sisters. Maybe it was the fact that he has a daughter to worry about. Maybe. But when a customer filled out an online comment card suggesting his waitstaff show more skin, the Atomic Grill responded. After considering the comment, we decided, McCauley said in a press release, that as a family restaurant, the only skin we were comfortable having our staff show more of was our potato skins.
The objectification of women in this sense is just offensive. I don't think it should be something that should be tolerated. I don't think that service needs to be about showing more skin. I think it should be about hospitality and about good food.
So one of those foods in this case is the common appetizer, potato skins. During the Memorial Day weekend, workers pushed the skins to raise awareness about rape prevention. And word spread quickly. Support has poured in from all over the state, the country, and even the world.
The reaction has been almost overwhelming. The community support, seeing our faces spread across all different news outlets all over the world, just knowing that there's that kind of support for raising this sort of awareness has just been absolutely wonderful.
This Atomic Grill event is kind of an example of something that we wish wasn't a big deal.
Proceeds from the popular potato plate went to the West Virginia Foundation for Rape Information and Services, or West Virginia FRIS. Sam Wilmoth and others from the nonprofit organization were hanging out at the restaurant all weekend, passing out information ready to talk or answer questions about sexual assault.
It goes to show, I think, how thirsty people are for this kind of thing. And it hurts my heart a little bit because it, you know, we do so many things in this culture, unfortunately, to make survivors of sexual violence feel ostracized and alone when it is demonstrably true that they are not.
In West Virginia, according to Frizz, 86% of victims of sexual assault are female, and 65% are younger than 18. 95% of offenders are male. Most offenses happen in the home of either the victim or the offender. And in West Virginia, sexual assault includes stalking and harassment. There are laws in place to try and combat the prevalence of these crimes. Shelters throughout the state provide free services to help sexual assault survivors, both short-term and long-term. But Wilmoth says we need to do more to take personal responsibility within our communities.
I would ask the listeners to make this event less noteworthy by sitting down with their sons at the dinner table and making it clear what they value by saying, look, it's super important to me that you treat every woman with the respect she deserves. That's just something that Smith's or Thomas's or whoever, that's just what we do. If we just had those conversations on the regular, then we could make a pretty big dent in this issue. Because what we know is that sexual violence is all about repeat perpetration, right? It's a tiny group of people doing it over and over and over and over again. And that means that there's this huge majority of people who could help if we just convince them that merely being nonviolent by itself is not enough. So I want them to make these events less special.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clintus Board in Morgantown.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Pettaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.